Welcome to the Emotional Curriculum with me, Dr. Sarah Taylor Whiteway. If you feel like traditional mental health support just offers more of the same, we have an antidote for this today. We talk with Dr. JJ Kelly, who offers a unique approach in building emotional intelligence skills. We talk about what her work involves and how schools can use some of these ideas in supporting children and young people. JJ, welcome to the Emotional Curriculum. Today we're going to talk about your work which teaches emotional intelligence skills to reduce the reliance on doctors and medication for our mental health. Before we start, could you explain a little bit about who you are and what you do?
It's evolved. I guess I got my doctorate back in 2006 and wrote my dissertation about how DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, should be taught in schools. And then I did psychoeducation and psychotherapy and lecturing and teaching for many years within the established system. And as the years went on, I could see that there are the same isms in the world that we're trying to get rid of certainly exist within the mental health system as it is today. So I thought something new had to happen. So I got out, shut down my private practice and started a company. And now I exclusively teach emotional intelligence skills training to people of all ages. Adolescents are my fave. They end up flocking to me and we have a good time. So that it's not so dependent on the doctor and what the doctor thinks. And we can figure out what your values are. And then I can give you the tools to help you support your behaviors aligning with your values, even when you're emotionally activated, when a lot of us cause messes. And a lot of the people that were once called patients, I don't use that anymore, students, and the advanced students I call docs to kind of dismantle the whole doctor worship thing that goes on. And they do peer coaching as well, and we do community outreach, and they do mentorship for the baby docs, the youngers, the under 18s. It's a cool thing to watch the advanced students teach and give. And it's a really cool thing to watch the newbies, the young ones, look up to them and the hope that, oh, I can be there too.
And there's lots there that we're going to come back to discuss later. But I wanted to start by asking you about your thesis, which you said looked into DBT in schools.
DBT has empirical data that it's a treatment for borderline personality disorder. My argument was that adolescence is much like a developmental stage of borderline personality disorder. So high highs, low lows, you know, the pendulum swings all over the place. And instead of waiting for a diagnosis and pathologizing a kid by giving them a borderline personality disorder diagnosis, why don't we just lift the pathology out of it, teach the skills at this developmental phase that it's already indicated for in a pathological sense. So why don't we just teach adolescents DBT, give them the skills before the all the over-medicating and the over-pathologizing? That was my argument.
A really interesting perspective about adolescence, and there's been lots of discussion about on medicalization of it at the moment. So interesting to see how we can use different approaches to support that time. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about what DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, is.
Yeah, my like one liner with that is the Venn diagram. My entire life is the Venn diagram, two circles intersected. DBT is, in terms of those two circles, it's Zen mindfulness meets cognitive behavior therapy. So that overlap slice in the middle is what we're going for. not black or white thinking, you know, live in the gray middle path, that kind of thing.
Okay, so bringing together that mindfulness, living in the moment, and the cognitive behavioral therapy of understanding how your thoughts, feelings, and behavior all interact. And for schools, there's been an emphasis on some of these things. Mindfulness particularly is gaining a lot of traction at the moment. What do you feel about schools' responsibility to bring these things into their practice?
Yeah, I mean, mindfulness as well as like social emotional learning, both of those are getting some traction. I used to teach my DBT courses in 16 week. I like the idea of it being a part of regular curriculum in school. It builds on itself. The first module is the mindfulness, core mindfulness skills module. Then I teach distress tolerance, then emotion regulation, and then interpersonal effectiveness training. So those all build as you go till the final module when you add the other person, which we can't control. So it's a total wild card. So you want all those other skills under your belt before you add the wild card factor of people that we can't control. You know, I always thought about it, and in the dissertation back when, I talked about it in terms of teaching it as required curriculum in high school. But, you know, through the pandemic, just as a coincidence, I've been getting younger and younger kids sent to me. So now I'm thinking middle school, before they start getting shitty, you know, I like the sassiness of high school age. However, that does reflect some reaction to something they're not liking. So maybe we can get them the skills. The second book, the Gifted Misfit book, is the 8-week course. And that's where all the emotional intelligence skills are. And it's a skinny little book. You know, I try to make everything potent and concise so you can just, it can be practical and you can learn from it. I think that as just a manual could teach a teacher a lot of how to implement these things into the classroom.
And we'll put a link to the book in the podcast description. And I'm wondering how easy you think it is for teachers to teach these skills if they aren't practicing them themselves.
I think one of the major reasons that the current mental health system isn't as effective as it could be is because the practitioners are performing what they've learned versus practicing what they teach. I think there's an inherent authenticity that maybe isn't even spoken, but people can feel. Teenagers, they know what's real. And if I'm real, they're going to trust me. Even if I have flaws, I don't have to be perfect. I just have to be myself, which, you know, is the only way I want to live. However, it also is an invitation for them to do the same and embrace flaws as well. Not like we don't work on them, but, you know, we get to have them. So that has an inherent trust built in it.
So the message is basically, if we're going to teach it in schools, we need to practice what we're telling and expecting the children and young people to do.
For sure. Because people can pick up on fakeness.
And one of the other things that you spoke about was the older students, the docs you called them, are mentoring, teaching the younger students. Could you talk a little bit more about how this works and what they gain from it?
Well, I just think that, you know, we just had a call on Tuesday with the whole big group together, the pre-docs and the docs. And wow, I'm just constantly blown away by the courage. It's April and my docs are very educated about the spring surge, is what I call it. A surge of energy comes in spring, and it's not necessarily positive. It depends what you do with that energy, and it makes a lot of people impulsive. And then they make messes, and that causes shame, which then they hide from, and that causes anxiety, which causes more impulsive behavior. I mean, it's a rotten cycle. So we try to get ahead of it and talk about it pre-April, and now we're in April, so we're definitely talking about it. So one of the docs was talking about that in a very complex, well-articulate, I mean, I was really blown away by her. How cool is that in real time to A, watch a person completely call themselves out, yet still maintain, because they're acting according to their values, maintain a sense of self-confidence and empowerment? It's not a shame spiral. It was standing in vulnerability as strength and telling the truth, even when it didn't make them look so great.
And I'm thinking about how schools can use this. And really what you're saying is someone who's got those emotional intelligence skills, who's got the confidence and the ability to reflect on what's happened and what's gone wrong and say it openly, is such a great role model to those younger students who may not be at that place yet.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And then it's not another adult just telling them what to do. I mean, the docs are adults too, but you know what I mean? Like somebody closer to their age.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. Someone that they look up to.
So you've also spoken about how you feel stress and anxiety is rising or different in adolescents these days. Could you talk a bit about that?
What I see is just less risk-taking in a way that's actually productive and like true to the developmental phase. The impulsivity is different. It's like they're too scared to do the rule-breaking stuff that we used to do, that's like pretty harmless. And I would argue builds resilience because, you know, you have to learn how to manage your fear to, you know, do streaking on campus or something like that. But it's like the anxiety and shame is much more present. I think that academic pressures are way more intense than they were for us. And I also think this parents want to be friends with their kids thing is really turning out anxious kids that are also ashamed. Because if the parents don't enforce consequences, then the kid never gets to be pissed off at the parent. Like the parents are worried that their kid's going to be mad at them. My argument is they need to be mad at you. Otherwise, they're going to turn that in on themselves. They're going to self-medicate their anger with shaming themselves. And they don't know where the lines are for safety and rules because the consequences are not telling them that in a practical way. So they've got way too much anxiety and way too much shame on board all the time. That erodes self-esteem and resilience in a big way. And I think that's a major difference.
It's interesting because you've not touched on the usual area of social media.
It's true, but everybody says that. There's a way to use social media that isn't so toxic. It's too easy to just blame social media. That is an externalization and oversimplification. That's a tool. That's like saying money is the problem. Yeah, money can be an issue, but you're going to put it all into that? No, that's a dodge, I think.
And so you've spoken there about anxiety and shame, and they seem closely linked. And you mentioned parents and potentially a role they play in that. And I'm wondering, what can schools do with these increasingly anxious and ashamed pupils?
Well, I think talking about it needs to happen. But I appreciate that there's so much that's put on the shoulders of teachers that this is yet another thing. I mean, like, the administration has to implement these skills as part of required curriculum, or it's just yet another thing heaped on a teacher's plate. But a very easy thing to do, that we go back to these basics all the time, is separating thoughts and feelings. So that could be a very simple practice that everyone could do in their classroom. So when someone's like, I feel like he's being a jerk, that's not a feeling, that's a thought. it's a judgment as well. So anything with an evaluative quality is a judgment, and it's therefore a thought. So if you say, I feel, that doesn't just make it a feeling. You have to say an emotion after that if it's really going to be taking responsibility and naming and validating an emotion. So if it's just that, helping kids identify and therefore validate their emotions instead of passing off thoughts as emotions, that alone could make a big dent in emotional intelligence in general.
And that is just a way of responding in the moment.
Sure. I mean, you could give a little intro, like a sheet that has emotions on it, and then continuously in the classroom, just every once in a while, if somebody's acting out, be like, how are you feeling right now? I feel like this is unfair. Well, that ain't no feeling. Pick something off of the feelings sheet.
So it's really about helping young people recognize the difference between the two, and when they can find an emotion and name that, that you can validate that somewhat. And another thing that's come up a lot in what you've spoken about is values. So I was wondering if you could talk about how you use these in your work.
I've been consistently surprised that we don't talk about them more. I've always done it in my practice, even as it's evolved, because I mean, every action, every behavior you engage in, whether you know it or not, is about what your values are. You know, I have everybody just like barf out onto the page what their values are. And then they get nervous, right? They're like, oh, I don't even know what a value is. Well, let's not overthink it. A lot of people, you know, honesty would be one. Or they say truth, telling the truth, something like that, whatever. Just write everything down and don't edit it. And then you'll see how they fold into each other. You know, you'll have telling the truth and honesty on it. Well, pick one, because those can be the same thing. And then you can come into the exercise with like a top five, let's say. And then when you have that top five, the next column can be behaviors that I engage in that maybe don't match my values. The ones that I'm currently engaging in that I know cause messes, that I get emotionally dysregulated and I give myself permission to act opposite of my actual values. So write those down. That already is, it's a resilience building exercise because you're admitting mistakes in that column, right? And then the third one is, instead of that behavior that I currently engage in that violates my values, what could I do instead? And now you have a blueprint of how you can act according to your values, which builds self-esteem and self-confidence, because, you know, you're going to have more joy in life because you're going to have a solidity in yourself because you are mostly acting according to your values. The other side of that coin is you're not engaging in behaviors that cause shame, and then you hide the shame, and then it causes anxiety, and that rotten loop. So you're going at it two very complex psychological ways in a very simple practice. But it can't just be talked about, it has to be practiced. And I think that's why it works, is because we don't just talk about it. They don't just take my word for it. They practice. And then when it works, they have their own data. Then they have more courage to try a new skill.
And I imagine part of that works is because the behavior is in line with their own values. There's much more motivation to do it rather than someone just saying you should tell the truth. And I think as well, this could be really useful in schools when schools are trying to persuade a young person to engage in a certain behavior, trying to align that with their values. So there's a reason, a meaning behind doing that behavior.
Because you could ask them in the moment when they are acting out and they're breaking school rules, you can say, okay, this is a school rule. You're breaking it. There's going to be a consequence for this. But is this behavior you're getting a consequence for? Does this match your values right now? Because mostly it's not going to. They're going to want to say, yeah, because when people get mad and then they are given consequences, they try to justify their behavior with like a self-righteous anger thing. Mm-hmm. But if you get right down to it, it probably is violating their own values as well. And when you get to that, you can say, well, how are you feeling as a result of your own behaviors? Maybe a little regret, maybe a little shame. Great. Now you know that you're going to get a consequence at school for breaking the rules if you do this. But maybe more important than that is you just eroded your self-esteem and self-confidence by behaving that way. Forget the consequence from school. There's a bigger consequence in your own sense of self and resilience and positive regard because you violated your own values.
And so to round off our discussion, if there was one thing you wanted educators to take from this discussion, what would it be?
I think that validation is the key, meaning we always validate someone's emotional experience, not the thoughts, certainly not the behaviors that are engaged in with high emotions, but just saying, how do you feel right now? And having a kid name their emotions and making sure it's an emotion word is an act of teaching them to internally validate their emotions. If they can do that, they might have a chance of separating knowing their emotions from all the thoughts that are generated by emotions, which are often not logical and definitely not factual. But just that separation can give them a moment to choose what they want to do about that emotion instead of just impulsively act. So even the naming of the emotion validates their emotion and brings that emotion down and closer to their baseline. So it reduces the potential of acting out. So if that was done in schools constantly, how are you feeling right now? Not even at an activated, you know, strike while the iron's cold too. Just have it be a regular part of the day. How are you feeling right now? Apprehensive. I have a math test. Like, how cool would that be if a kid can just say that as they're walking down the hall and be like, thanks for asking, and keep going. So they just regulated their emotion for the math test by naming it too. It is simple, powerful in practice. Like, everybody kind of knows this is logical and true, yet nobody really teaches us how to do it, and so we don't.
And it sounds like you're creating that pause for thought, because we have a lot of teenagers and young people and children who might say they feel the behavior is out of their control, that impulsivity, and by asking them, you're helping create that pause between the feeling and the behavior.
Right. And then they are practicing internal validation instead of looking outside themselves for validation of their own emotional experience. That's what happens. Adults haven't learned along the way how to internally validate. So they're constantly dependent on their environment and grasping for validation within the environment. That causes a lot of insecurity in a lot of adults. So if we can teach the process of internal validation early, there'll be a lot more happy people on the planet.
And that would be great. And a really important note to end on. JJ, thank you so much for your discussion today. And thank you for listening. You'll find the link to JJ's work in the podcast description. If you like this episode, then please do subscribe. And you can follow us on Twitter at emcurriculum. You can email us on theemotionalcurriculum@gmail.com. See you soon.